Državni ispitni center.
Maturità generale 2013.
Prova d'ascolto.
A tutti voi un cordiale saluto. Siamo all'inizio della prova d'ascolto d'inglese.
Questa prova d'esame si compone di due parti, la parte A e la parte B. Per ciascuna parte ascolterete un testo e risponderete poi a un esercizio che a esso si ricollega. Dapprima leggerete l'esercizio, poi ascolterete ciascun testo per due volte e risolverete l'esercizio durante l'ascolto. L'inizio e la fine del testo saranno indicati dal seguente segnale acustico.
Scrivete le vostre risposte negli spazi appositamente previsti all'interno della prova, utilizzando la penna stilografica o la penna a sfera. Scrivete in modo leggibile e ortograficamente corretto. In caso di errore, tracciate un segno sulla risposta scorretta e scrivete accanto ad essa quella corretta. Alle risposte e alle correzioni scritte in modo illeggibile verranno assegnati 0 punti.
Abbiate fiducia in voi stessi e nelle vostre capacità. Vi auguriamo buon lavoro.
Ascoltate con attenzione. Aprite la prova d'esame.
Section A. You will hear an interview with Felicity Goodall about her trip to Burma. You will hear the recording twice. Now read the task.
Now, 70 years ago, the Japanese began their invasion of Burma, then a British colony. No one expected it, and as news spread, 500,000 civilians set out to escape, making a remarkable trek northwest from Burma to India in early 1942. Inspired partly by her father, who served in the British Army there, Felicity Goodall decided to retrace the steps taken by the evacuees. The result is a book, Exodus Burma, The British Escape Through the Jungles of Death, in which she charts the horrific journey and the experiences of those who survived. Felicity joins me from Plymouth. Good morning, Felicity. Had you always wanted to make this journey, and what finally prompted you to undertake it?
I'd always been fascinated because I'd grown up with this scar on my father's arm, a 6-inch-long scar up the inside of his forearm from the wrist. And the story of it, that he'd been shot at by the Japanese and that he'd had to swim with this dreadful wound. But I'd never really considered I'd actually go to Burma. I mean, it's one of those places that people just don't get to.
Exactly.
So I suppose I never really thought I'd go. And when I decided that I was going to go, everyone I talked to thought I was completely mad, including my father.
No, when you got there, you were, you know, off the tourist trail going into wild country. Where did you actually start?
Well, I started in Rangoon, and then, unlike most tourists who fly from there up to Mandalay, I went by car, a very battered Toyota Corolla with very squeaky springs, and we set off by road, and the roads are quite incredible, and, you know, they're like the tracks are in this country, or the worst of a Scottish or Irish road, if they're metalled. Yeah. And we went along lots of fair-weather roads, which are essentially sort of a foot of dust on top of the ground, so that when it rains, that turns into mud. I was there during March, April, which is not the rainy season.
And how did they receive you? Just thinking of, as you said, not many people go to Burma, perhaps full stop, let alone will go off deep off the tourist trail, travelling along these dusty roads. What did they make of you, a woman travelling alone?
Well, they'd sort of stop and look, and I'd wave out of the car as I waved at all the children, every single child I saw in Burma, and many adults, and they'd just wave enthusiastically back. And at one point we were travelling along a fairweather road, which was obviously being shored up with a few rocks and things, and there was a whole group of children who were doing the road mending, and I said to the driver, oh, please stop, you know, and I thought I must give them something. What can I give them, these tiny little children? And as soon as the car stopped, they just ran really fast up through the dust. And I gave them this huge bunch of bananas, because you can't just buy two, you have to buy, you know, 25 in a huge bunch, and all the local currency I had. And they just smiled and looked at me in wonder and said, Manchester United. International language.
Of course it is. That's brilliant. Now, you actually travelled up the Irrawaddy River to the point, I think, where your father was shot. What was that like?
Yes, that was extraordinary. I went by car to Nyang U, which is actually very close to Bagan, where there are 4,000 temples on the plain there. And when I got up on the morning that we were going to actually go on the river, and it was dawn and I could hear all the birds piping away on the sort of marshy bit going down to the river, and then suddenly the little motors of the boat starting up and fishermen going out and casting their nets, and slowly it began to get lighter. I got very emotional. I did dreadful sort of little letters to my father on tape saying, Dad, I'm here, and this is the same that you saw, because he was there waiting as a young soldier at dawn to take part in this river crossing.
Now you will hear the recording again.
Now, 70 years ago, the Japanese began their invasion of Burma, then a British colony. No one expected it, and as news spread, 500,000 civilians set out to escape, making a remarkable trek northwest from Burma to India in early 1942. Inspired partly by her father, who served in the British Army there, Felicity Goodall decided to retrace the steps taken by the evacuees. The result is a book, Exodus Burma, The British Escape Through the Jungles of Death, in which she charts the horrific journey and the experiences of those who survived. Felicity joins me from Plymouth. Good morning, Felicity. Had you always wanted to make this journey, and what finally prompted you to undertake it?
I'd always been fascinated because I'd grown up with this scar on my father's arm, a 6-inch long scar up the inside of his forearm from the wrist. And the story of it, that he'd been shot at by the Japanese and that he'd had to swim with this dreadful wound. But I'd never really considered that I'd actually go to Burma. I mean, it's one of those places that people just don't get to.
Exactly.
So I suppose I never really thought I'd go. And when I decided that I was going to go, everyone I talked to thought I was completely mad, including my father.
No, you when you got there, you were, you know, off the tourist trail going into wild country. Where did you actually start?
Well, I started in Rangoon, and then, unlike most tourists who fly from there up to Mandalay, I went by car, a very battered Toyota Corolla with very squeaky springs, and we set off by road, and the roads are quite incredible, and, you know, they're like the tracks are in this country, or the worst of a Scottish or Irish road, if they're metalled. Yeah. And we went along lots of fair-weather roads, which are essentially sort of a foot of dust on top of the ground, so that when it rains, that turns into mud. I was there during March, April, which is not the rainy season.
And how did they receive you? Just thinking of, as you said, not many people go to Burma, perhaps full stop, let alone will go off deep off the tourist trail travelling along these dusty roads. What did they make of you, a woman travelling alone?
Well, they'd sort of stop and look, and I'd wave out of the car as I waved at all the children, every single child I saw in Burma, and many adults, and they'd just wave enthusiastically back. And at one point we were travelling along a fairweather road, which was obviously being shored up with a few rocks and things, and there was a whole group of children who were doing the road mending, and I said to the driver, oh, please stop, you know, and I thought I must give them something. What can I give them, these tiny little children? And as soon as the car stopped, they just ran really fast up through the dust. And I gave them this huge bunch of bananas, because you can't just buy two, you have to buy, you know, 25 in a huge bunch, and all the local currency I had. And they just smiled and looked at me in wonder and said, Manchester United. International language.
Of course it is. That's brilliant. Now, you actually travelled up the Irrawaddy River to the point, I think, where your father was shot. What was that like?
Yes, that was extraordinary. I went by car to Nyang U, which is actually very close to Bagan, where there are 4,000 temples on the plain there. And when I got up on the morning that we were going to actually go on the river, and it was dawn and I could hear all the birds piping away on the sort of marshy bit going down to the river, and then suddenly the little motors of the boat starting up and fishermen going out and casting their nets, and slowly it began to get lighter. And I was I got very emotional. I did dreadful sort of little letters to my father on tape saying, Dad, I'm here and this is the same that you saw, because he was there waiting as a young soldier at dawn to take part in this river crossing.
This is the end of Section A. Section B. You will hear an interview with Paul Watson, a footballer. You will hear the recording twice. Now read the task.
Now, Englishman Paul Watson is mad about football, and ever since he was a small boy, he's dreamed of playing at international level. Once he'd grown up, he managed some semi-professional games, but realised he'd never be good enough to play for England or any other top-flight nation. So he searched the world rankings to see if there was an international team so low down that they might accept him. With his friend Matt, he eventually settled on the tiny island of Pohnpei in Micronesia in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, north of Papua New Guinea. Pohnpei's team had never won a game and weren't even recognised by FIFA. Paul came into the Outlook studio to tell me how his quest played out.
I knew very little about the place, but my research told me it was, I think it's the third wettest place on Earth in terms of just annual rainfall, and that there's kind of very high obesity rate and a big American influence. And those were the three things I kind of knew before setting out.
So you arrived in Pohnpei. What was the situation when you arrived there? Did they have a training ground? Did they have a kit? Did they have a team?
There were a few people playing, and
say 11?
Fewer than 11, I think. It was more kind of a regular organised 4-on-4, 5-on-5 game. So
not even enough for a national side?
Not enough at that time,
but obviously leaving an opportunity for you to step in and become the 11th, presumably.
Exactly. It would have been. With the initial plan, I would have been guaranteed a starting place, I think. But actually, what we found was it was this astonishing stadium that had been built for the Micronesian Games, but it was in a kind of a state of rotting. It was because of the heavy rainfall, there was this kind of slightly rotten running track, a pitch that regularly flooded, was almost always flooded, and was covered in toads. It's actually a toad habitat.
Right. So when you tried to play a game amongst the toads, what happened?
Regularly the ball would be diverted slightly by toads, or you'd find yourself kicking a toad.
And you could often be underwater, presumably, if it rained heavily.
Certain parts of the pitch were almost always underwater, and there were notorious regions of the pitch where the ball would stick in kind of this puddles, and it would take, you know, a minute or so to get the ball out of them. It was a very odd environment.
What about a gym for training in?
We used a gym that it's called the Hideaway Gym, because it's almost impossible to find. And it's actually just someone's house, and it's kind of above a pig pen, and it had all this fantastic equipment. I mean, it was these very old, rusty barbells and dumbbells. It barely had a roof, but it was just this fantastic environment where all the players would come down and train in there.
And how did they react to you, an Englishman, turning up and saying, I'm going to galvanise the international team here in Micronesia?
So at first I think I was regarded with a mixture of suspicion and probably hilarity. I think people thought this was some odd, misguided gap year project, and that I'd be gone pretty shortly with my tail between my legs.
Was there a moment when they started to take you seriously?
I was there for a few months. We set up a league, and even when I was setting up the league, I think people regarded me as a bit of an oddball. And then there was a day that we marked out the pitch, and we did it on the hottest day of the year in Pohnpei. So this was, you know, nearly 40 degrees, sweltering sunlight, and we were doing it with just house paint and brushes. So that takes hours and hours, and it was just a group of about six of us, the most committed players and myself. And I burnt terribly, as any Englishman would in those conditions.
You got terrible sunburn.
Terrible sunburn, just everywhere. But I still had to referee the games for this tournament. So I refereed the games in this kind of awful state, looking atrocious and looking kind of half dead. And I think from then on, the players kind of warmed to me because they saw that, you know, he's not just here for a holiday. He's willing to get boiled.
To suffer for his art.
Exactly.
Well, as the Islanders began to trust him, Paul's league grew until around 100 people were taking part.
Now you will hear the recording again.
Now, Englishman Paul Watson is mad about football, and ever since he was a small boy, he's dreamed of playing at international level. Once he'd grown up, he managed some semi-professional games, but realised he'd never be good enough to play for England or any other top-flight nation. So he searched the world rankings to see if there was an international team so low down that they might accept him. With his friend Matt, he eventually settled on the tiny island of Pohnpei in Micronesia in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, north of Papua New Guinea. Pohnpei's team had never won a game and weren't even recognised by FIFA. Paul came into the Outlook studio to tell me how his quest played out.
I knew very little about the place, but my research told me it was, I think it's the third wettest place on Earth in terms of just annual rainfall, and that there's kind of very high obesity rate and a big American influence. And those were the three things I kind of knew before setting out.
So you arrived in Pohnpei. What was the situation when you arrived there? Did they have a training ground? Did they have a kit? Did they have a team?
There were a few people playing, and
say 11?
Fewer than 11, I think. It was more kind of a regular organised 4-on-4, 5-on-5 game. So
not even enough for a national side?
Not enough at that time,
but obviously
no.
Leaving an opportunity for you to step in and become the 11th, presumably.
Exactly. It would have been. With the initial plan, I would have been guaranteed a starting place, I think. But actually, what we found was it was this astonishing stadium that had been built for the Micronesian Games, but it was in a kind of a state of rotting. It was because of the heavy rainfall, there was this kind of slightly rotten running track, a pitch that regularly flooded, was almost always flooded, and was covered in toads. It's actually a toad habitat.
Right. So when you tried to play a game amongst the toads, what happened?
Regularly, the ball would be diverted slightly by toads, or you'd find yourself kicking a toad.
And you could often be underwater, presumably, if it rained heavily.
Certain parts of the pitch were almost always underwater, and there were notorious regions of the pitch where the ball would stick in kind of this puddles, and it would take, you know, a minute or so to get the ball out of them. It was a very odd environment.
What about a gym for training in?
We used a gym that it's called the Hideaway Gym because it's almost impossible to find. And it's actually just someone's house, and it's kind of above a pig pen, and it had all this fantastic equipment. I mean, it was these very old, rusty barbells and dumbbells. It barely had a roof, but it was just this fantastic environment where all the players would come down and train in there.
And how did they react to you, an Englishman, turning up and saying, I'm going to galvanise the international team here in Micronesia?
So at first I think I was regarded with a mixture of suspicion and probably hilarity. I think people thought this was some odd, misguided gap year project and that I'd be gone pretty shortly with my tail between my legs.
Was there a moment when they started to take you seriously?
I was there for a few months. We set up a league. And even when I was setting up the league, I think people regarded me as a bit of an oddball. And then there was a day that we marked out the pitch, and we did it on the hottest day of the year in Pohnpei. So this was, you know, nearly 40 degrees, sweltering sunlight, and we were doing it with just house paint and brushes. So that takes hours and hours, and it was just a group of about six of us, the most committed players and myself. And I burnt terribly, as any Englishman would in those conditions.
You got terrible sunburn.
Terrible sunburn, just everywhere. But I still had to referee the games for this tournament, so I refereed the games in this kind of awful state, looking atrocious and looking kind of half dead. And I think from then on, the players kind of warmed to me because they saw that, you know, he's not just here for a holiday, he's willing to get boiled.
To suffer for his
art. Exactly.
Well, as the Islanders began to trust him, Paul's league grew until around 100 people were taking part.
This is the end of section B.
Siamo alla conclusione della prova d'ascolto d'inglese. Smettete di scrivere, chiudete la prova d'esame e posatela sull'orlo del banco insieme alla scheda di valutazione.
Ancora un cordiale saluto.